Oh, yeah, I do.
I guess I should read the gospel she has.
You should get her.
Would you turn to Mark chapter 16 and let me read the first 8 verses? When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb, and they were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled back. It was very large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe. And they were alarmed. He said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who is crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him? But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid.
Okay, good morning again. It's so exciting to be here. I love coming and teaching for women. It's kind of my thing that I do. And isn't Pastor Glenn great? He's so knowledgeable, and I learned so much from him, and I'm sure all of you do too. So let's get started by saying, hey, you did it, right? You got through the end of Mark. You've read the entire book of the Bible. And today what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about this epilogue or this final act, the death of Jesus Christ and the empty tomb. But before I get started this morning, I wanted to hand the mic over to someone else. See, this is what you do. You're given a responsibility and then you pass the buck. No, I'm not doing that, but she's been so gracious to help me out here to drive home the point that I'm going to get to eventually this morning. So I asked Kathy Krivicek if she would come on up here and share her personal testimony, because we're going to be talking about why testimonies are so important. Because this week you talked about, we learned a little bit in the scriptures talked about Mary Magdalene, right? Mary, the mother of James and Salome. And why were their testimonies important? And why are they even credible? So, Kathy, would you come on up and share your story?
I have a couple things to say before I get started. Oh, sorry. I don't know how to use that. There are a lot of ladies here. I'm like super nervous. I'm super nervous. I know there's lots of grace here, so it's all good. And the second thing I'm going to tell you, for those of you who don't know me, is that I have a tendency to cry at the drop of a hat. Just letting you know that, and the water table's pretty high today, so. But I did bring my tissues. Thank you. So I just, you know, bear with me if it happens. Just let me talk through it. I know it'll be bad. It embarrasses me when it happens, but oh well, it just happens. That's the way God made me. So anyway, as Dawn mentioned, I'm Kathy Krivicek. My husband Chip and I moved here 20 years ago this August with our 3 kids, who at the time were 11 and 8 and 4. We joined Good Shepherd in June of 2000. My faith journey begins actually in 1957, the year I was born, at 9 pounds, 11 ounces. Everybody gasp. I tell you that because I'm quite sure that God planned for me to be big because he knew what was coming. My folks were young. I was their first child. My dad was in school on a football scholarship at U of I, and my mom worked at the phone company. There was only one back then when I was born. Unbeknownst to them, I had a condition that kept me from getting the nourishment I needed, a condition that doctors at the time thought was something that only boy babies got. Anyway, to make a long story short, at 1 month of age, I was still at birth weight. Good thing is, this is what happens. They found it, they fixed it, and I didn't die. The God thing is that I was born with enough weight to keep me alive until they did. So, when you ask me when God became real to me, I can honestly say I can't remember a time when I didn't know him. He's always been real to me. Now I haven't always followed, have I always followed his commands and walked in his ways? And like all the time? Nope. But if I got sidetracked for a while, I always found my way back. It actually wasn't until I got to Good Shepherd and went to Christ Renews His Parish Retreat in Formation that Jesus stole my heart. I fell in love with him and just couldn't get enough. I will tell you that if any of you haven't done that, you really should. It's cool. And hopefully it'll change your life like it did mine. Little sidebar here. At one point in my life, well, I was about 45 or so, I was taking an antidepressant for some anxiety issues, since depression kind of runs in my family. And after taking it for a while, I remember complaining to my mom that I didn't want to do anything except sit around and read my Bible. To which she responded, "What's wrong with that?" And I said, "Nothing, as long as you don't send your kids to school dirty and hungry." Anyway, Bible study became my passion. I just wanted to learn all I could about God's character and how his word could speak to me personally. So I started with Thursday morning Bible study and then to growth groups. And I've been doing that for the last 18 plus years. I know some of the rest of you are just the same. You've been here just as long. Now, this is all good stuff to tell you. But I think Don asked me to speak today so I could tell you a specific part of my story. So a few years ago, my husband Chip was diagnosed with a rare lung disease. The doctors decided that he was going to need a transplant. So the wheels were set in motion to get that done. There were lots of tests and information to process beforehand. In one of those informational sessions we had, we were given a 2-inch thick binder of rules. I am so sorry. Let me do that and get it out of the way. All these rules we were going to have to follow once the transplant was completed. That made me really nervous, considering Chip was a man who met a rule he didn't ever want to break. He's a rule breaker. In another session, we found out that 50% of lung transplant patients don't survive past 5 years. Mostly because other transplants, like kidneys and liver and heart, are inside your body and it's sealed up and there's no more exposure to the outside world. But with lungs, you are breathing in outside air 17,000 times a day. Makes it a little iffy sometimes. And that would make me nervous too. Then we got the word that a lung was available. They took Chip in for surgery, only to find that he was much, much sicker than they originally thought. His transplant was scheduled, he was scheduled for one lung. But when they opened him up and got in there, they found that both lungs were completely shot, and they should have been transplanting actually too. He was never stable enough after surgery to remove the ventilator, and so he can never be without sedation. He never regained consciousness and then crashed 2 days later. They revived him, but the prognosis was grim. He had simply been without oxygen way too long. He stayed that way for 10 days. What a roller coaster ride that was. The memories of his last 2 weeks in the hospital make me want to weep even now. See? After 5.5 years. I'm sure the chapel at the University of Chicago Hospital has a dent in the cushion where I spent many hours sitting or kneeling in front of it with my head in that space instead. Lord, I prayed the testimony he would have if you would revive him. His heart has been so full of you the last 2 years. He has wanted nothing more than to make you known. I know this would be his purpose if you would bring him back to us. Please, God. And then the hardest thing I've ever had to pray. But not your will, Lord. Not my will, but yours. Because after all, he is our holy God and our sovereign Lord. At the end of that 10 days, we removed Chip from the life support. But all of that is just background info for what I really want to tell you. You see, Chip had a very rare blood type, so we were fortunate to have a lung become available at all. In fact, had they known that Chip needed two lungs, I'm convinced he would have died waiting for a double lung donor with the right blood type. I have no doubt that would have been even more devastating to me and our kids than the way it actually happened. God's grace and mercy for sure. Another time, God showed us his love and wisdom using a comment from my youngest daughter. At one point, Kara reminded me about how her dad had a habit of never following the rules. In that short conversation, I felt God giving me just a glimpse of what he already knew. Because of that conversation, I could see that if Chip had survived the transplant, the chances were very great that he would have been one of those less than 5-year survivor statistics. He would have surely disregarded the transplant rules, and then, instead of dying when he did, he would have died sometime within the next 5 years. Because he chose not to do what he was supposed to. And if that would have happened, not only would the kids and I have been sad, we would have been furious with him too. So at least this way, we were only sad. And I tell you that to show you how, through all of that, God was merciful and gracious, loving, faithful, wise, and holy during that terrible time. Because our God knows the future and everything that will happen, he knew the number of days that Chip would have on this earth. He also knew where that would leave me. I'm convinced that he put love of his word in my heart so I would spend all that time getting to know him and his character, so I would be able to hear his voice when I needed it. And when I was faced with these terrible circumstances and questions were right up in my face, questions like, do you believe God knows what you need more than I do? What I need more than? Do you believe that God has your best interests at heart? Do you believe his plan for your life, which may include this thing which you do not think looks very good, is ultimately good? I would be able to answer yes. Yes, God, even if this is your will for my life, I still believe that you are for me and you have goodness in store for me, even and maybe especially when it doesn't feel like you do.
I think you might have my notes.
Oh, sorry. That's okay.
There we go. Thank you, honey. So we don't get too much interference here. So testimonies are powerful, aren't they? Even when maybe our prayers aren't answered exactly the way we'd hope, we still have hope listening to Kathy's testimony. You know, it's one thing to hear the message. But it's quite something else to meet the risen Lord personally. I believe that Kathy, in her testimony, in that moment, I believe in that moment, even though it was sad and God wasn't answering her prayers the way she wanted, she met the Lord when he spoke to her in that story where her daughter, Kara, shared with her. He spoke to her heart. He transforms lives. So a life that's been brought up from the grave, right? What about your resurrection? If you are in Christ and you know him personally, we all have a resurrection story where we've been brought up from the grave, so to speak. Well, this morning I want to talk about two things since you've been studying Mark. And one is, and you'll notice that I had Pastor Glenn only read verses 1 through 8. That's really where we're going to zone in. I'll touch on 9 through 20, but that won't be until the end. So what I want to talk about here is really what happened. And the second thing is how it changes us. And I think by the end you'll understand why, even better why I had Kathy come on up here and share her testimony. So when we consider the testimony of the women and the hope of the world, this is what we'll discover today. First, the testimony of the women. So this chapter opens up talking about Mary Magdalene being there, Mary the mother of James being there, and Salome, right? And what's clear about these first eight verses is that Mark is very precise about documenting and presenting these events we have here in verses 1 through 8 as being incontrovertible and actual historical events. Everything about this section from the empty tomb, the women, the man who appears in the tomb. Everything here is designed to present these events as historically accurate, precise, and reliable. In fact, there are verifiable accounts to which this addresses. And it's not just legend or a myth. One theologian that I studied, he's a New Testament scholar from St. Andrews in Scotland. His name is Richard Barkham. He suggests about this that in general, throughout the ancient Mediterranean world, eyewitness testimony was one of the most significant, if not the most significant, source of historical material. It was absolutely critical for ancient historiography. Historians would rely on eyewitness testimonies as much as they possibly could. But now, eyewitness testimonies, though, right, by their very nature, can be selective, right? If Kathy stood up here with her daughter, Kara, and they were to recount what happened with Chip, their stories would be similar, but they wouldn't be exact, right? So, Let's just take this more to your personal event, for you to make it personal for you. If you and a friend were to witness the same event, right? Let's say you and a friend went to a concert or to a play, or maybe you and your husband or a friend went to see a baseball game, and you were sitting next to one another. You had the same vantage point. Your recounting of the event would be slightly different, wouldn't it? Even if you saw the same exact event. Why? Because events, things that happen in life, speak to each one of us differently. One of you might comment on the costumes in the play and the acting, while the other might comment on the singing or the choreography. You saw the same exact play. You saw the same exact concert, but your recounting of it would be slightly different. Neither is untrue. They're just from a different perspective. I'll give you one of my examples. So when my husband and Tony and I went on our first date, this is interesting, when we both recount it, right? Your kids, they'll ask you, well, how did you meet? And, you know, what was your first date like? And so my husband, he's in insurance, and he doesn't sell insurance. He's more on the business side of it. And he's very analytical about things, right? He's methodical about things. And, you know, me, I'm a Bible teacher, and I pretty much just fly by the seat of my pants. You can ask Kathy. I asked her yesterday, hey, can you do this tomorrow? You see, my husband, when he recounts that first date to our kids, he knows the date. I know that it was sometime around Labor Day. He remembers what I was wearing. Honestly, I don't even remember what I wore yesterday, let alone 30 plus years ago, right? He remembers where we went to dinner and what both of us ate, and I believe that we probably ate. he remembers the movie. I remember that we went to a movie. You know, he sees everything exactly the way it was in his mind because he's a fact checker, right? And I paint life with this broad brush. You see, this is some sort of natural selectivity, I think. And because there are different emphases on eyewitness accounts, this is precisely why we need multiple accounts to get an entire picture. So this is why Richard Bauckham says that this is why we have four Gospels instead of one. So what you see in each writer of the Gospels is a very high commitment to establishing eyewitness credibility, an accurate historical picture. And in particular, Bauckham, he notices that in similar Gospel accounts, parallel accounts throughout the Gospels, there are some accounts where names are used, right? Specific names. And there are other accounts, though, where the names are left out entirely. And maybe you've had conversations with people where they'll argue about this, right? This is all just made up. They're not the same. So, for instance, Bartimaeus. Bartimaeus is mentioned in Mark, but nowhere else in any other gospel. In the other gospels, he's just mentioned as the blind man. Or another would be the man whose ear was cut off in the Garden of Gethsemane. Well, his name was Malchus, but John is the only gospel writer who mentions him by name. His name is omitted everywhere else. And even here in verse 1, it says, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome were at the tomb. But Salome does not come up in any other gospel account. And what Bauckham has suggested is that the reason and purpose for this kind of selective specificity, Bartimaeus, Malcolm, Salome, is that the purpose is to identify and name specific eyewitnesses. Instead of simply saying, you know, the blind man, because presumably there could have been more than one blind man, the purpose is to identify specific eyewitnesses who were likely still around. Even if the book, as Pastor Glenn had mentioned, hadn't been written for years later, this blind man, Bartimaeus, could have still been around. He could have still been accessible during the circulation of the Gospels. So in other words, the reason blind Bartimaeus is mentioned in Mark and not any other gospel is because Bartimaeus was presumably still known in the region. And he was still around when the book of Mark was being circulated, which meant you could actually go find Bartimaeus and confirm or verify with him personally regarding these facts. You could presumably still talk to Mary, the mother of James, or to Salome, or Mary Magdalene to verify with them, which is precisely why they're named specifically in some gospel accounts and not others, because they were still around and they could still verify their testimony. So what you see in these verses is a total commitment to historical accounting by Mark. But look, not only Mark is precise in naming the eyewitnesses at the tomb, but also at the death of Jesus and the burial of Jesus. And this is really important here. You know, if we go back to Mark 15:40, it describes Jesus' death. And the text says that Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome were on hand to see the death of Jesus. Then, if we move along to verse 47 of chapter 15, we read about the burial of Jesus. And this time, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, is mentioned, but not Salome. So what we see, even in the omission of Salome here, is this utter commitment to the smallest and most minute details of this event. Instead of saying, you know, those women or some women were there, he makes absolutely clear who was at each event, just in case you needed to find them and do a little fact-checking yourself. So what's significant in particular about the fact that Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, that they were there at the death, the burial, and the empty tomb of Jesus, is that this is precisely what is needed to establish a foolproof, airtight testimony. That is why, that it was in fact the same Jesus who died, the same Jesus who was buried, and is now gone. And to make it better, you have two independent eyewitnesses giving critical testimony for establishing the resurrection account. If any one of these stages, the death, the burial, the empty tomb, if at any one of these stages they hadn't been there, then any testimony about the resurrection of Jesus would have really been meaningless. For instance, let's say you were there and you saw Jesus die and you saw the empty tomb, but you didn't see his burial, then it's actually clear, it isn't actually clear that Jesus had risen, because it could have been possible that he had never been in the tomb to begin with. Or if you saw Jesus buried and you witnessed the empty tomb, but you didn't see him die, it would be possible, there could be an argument out there, that he wasn't actually dead when he was placed in the tomb. He was just passed out, wounded. But he got out on his own, which would explain, right, how he got out. Or if you saw Jesus die and then buried, but not the empty tomb, then for all you know, he could still be in the tomb. Does this make sense at all? I feel like, you know, the who's on first, what's on second. But you get it, right? There's an importance that they were there and that Mark mentions them specifically at each point so that their testimony can be verified. So what Mark does in naming these women, particularly Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, both of who were at all three, the death, the burial, and the empty tomb, is to establish two independent eyewitness accounts who had seen everything from the start to the finish, and who are perfectly credible witnesses. Now, there may be one or two of you, but I doubt it. But for sure, we know somebody who's like this. I have my good friend Mike, who is the agnostic in my life, and he doesn't mind that I share this with you because he's always trying to argue with me over these points. And Mike will say something like this. He'll say, well, it's possible that this is just very well researched, right? Or very well crafted legend. You know, maybe he'll say it's historical fiction or it's a period piece, you know, kind of like Tom Clancy. It's very close to reality and in the historical events, but yet, you know, it's still fictional. In fact, many have suggested that the Gospels were written by the later church in order to establish their mission in the church. That basically what the church had done was write backstories to bolster and support and validate their beliefs and the mission of the church. Now that's what you get into a little bit in the later verses of Mark, but we're really talking verses 1 through 8, and again, I'll touch on 9 through 20 at the end. You know, I always will ask Mike, I'll say something like this to him when he gives me this whole historical propaganda, blah, 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 you know. I'll say, Mike, don't you see that if it had been the church's goal to bolster their beliefs and bolster their mission by writing what is historical propaganda or legend, don't you see how unfit the story would have been? You see, throughout the ancient world, particularly in conventions of the Roman and Jewish prudence, women weren't even allowed to be witnesses in a court of law. The testimony of a woman was totally inadmissible in judicial proceedings. So it was precisely this fact that the eyewitnesses of the death, the burial, and the empty tomb were women. When you hear people say that God doesn't love women, that the Bible is restrictive, all this stuff, right? God loves women. He let us be the first to see the whole thing. And this is why this historical account is all the more convincing. It makes the idea that these were fictional legends written later for the church that much more improbable. What you see throughout the Gospels is the fact that Jesus consistently favored outsiders over insiders. The marginalized over the powerful. The younger son over the older son. Jesus was totally contrary to cultural convention or any other cultural norm. If Mark were writing historical propaganda, then most certainly what he would have done is write in a way that supported the current leaders of that time. Just makes sense, right? The current leaders of authority in the church, who would have been namely men. This just cracks me up when I think about this stuff, right? He never would have chosen Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James to support his agenda, even if they had been there for all three events, because their testimony would have been faulty to begin with and inadmissible. I just gave you some ammunition, didn't I? Not only would he not have chosen women, but look at how Mark ends in what many scholars believe is the end of the chapter. In verse 8, he writes, "Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid." If Mark or the other gospel writers were writing their gospels to support a cause led by men, they would have never written it like that. They would have never written that the main witnesses were women and therefore inadmissible, and that after they'd seen evidence of the resurrection, that they went away afraid. What they would have written instead is something like, "They were men who then went out courageously and boldly proclaiming the faith with great success wherever they went." So the storyline is so unconventional and so countercultural that it's hard to imagine that anyone would have ever written this as historical propaganda. What is clear throughout the book of Mark is that Mark took utmost care to ensure that these writings followed every convention for historical writing. We cannot overlook the fact that Mark, from everything we understand about ancient historiography, that he intended for this to be a historical account. Not just a story, and not just legend, and not just historical fiction. So I'm going to be frank here, and this is basically what I say to my friend Mike every time we get into one of these conversations. If you were to read this as having some kind of propagandist agenda, if you were trying to look for a hidden agenda, the only way you'll find one is if you put one there. You can't simply read this as fiction unless you want it to be fiction, or unless you've already made up your mind that the resurrection didn't even happen. But if you read this text fairly, you simply cannot say that Mark intended for this to be fictional legend. And that pretty much just ends our conversation. I mean, he'll balk a little bit and blah, 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 you know. He still thinks that it's the church that is trying to manipulate. So, if these events are really true, and if the resurrection really did happen, and if this is factual history, what are the implications? What do we do with this? What does this mean? Well, let's consider how this gives us hope for the world. So in verses 6 to 7, we see the application of the resurrection. Mark writes, "Don't be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him, but go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." In particular, we see that he writes, "But go." He is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. I want you to remember that. Notice he doesn't say, "Hey, don't worry about it. It's okay. Jesus is gone. He went to heaven." And he doesn't say something like, "Don't worry about it. You know, listen, Jesus died, but he is in a much, much better place. And you know what? You will see him again soon one day." Instead, he says, "Go. He is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you." In other words, what we see is in Jesus Christ is not just a figurative resurrection or a spiritual resurrection. Jesus has gone to heaven, and so can you. What we see is far more profound and much more significant. What you see in the physical and literal resurrection is basically this. Whatever was once decaying or broken can be made new and restored. Whatever was dead can receive new life. Jesus is no longer dead. He's alive. And you can see him for yourself in flesh and blood. What the literal and physical resurrection means is if there has been a bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ, then there is real hope for the world. There is life where there was once death. There is healing where there was once brokenness. In other words, the resurrection means that this world matters and that it can be made new. Now, when you look at two different sides, and I don't pick either one, if you look at the classic conservative Christian view, it has always suggested what really matters at the end of the day is this moral reformation. What really matters is your spiritual. Nothing else really matters. As long as you have that come to Jesus moment, you're good, right? Personal spiritual piety and renewal. Because at the end of the day, the world was just going to be destroyed and no longer a part of it. So there's this tendency for the classic conservative Christian to overvalue the supernatural at the expense of the material reality. On the other hand, then, we have our classic liberal Christian point of view that always says, let's not worry so much about the supernatural stuff. In the end, what matters is that we try to help the world. And what matters is that we try to cure as many social ills as possible. And that along the way, we work for social change, but not so much for this spiritual inner transformation. And there's this tendency to overvalue material reality over supernatural reality. But don't you see that if you fully understand the literal and physical resurrection that Jesus Christ supernaturally rose from physical death, then what you see is that both supernatural and material, both really matter. They're both important, equally. That material reality matters much, much more than what conservatives might say, and that supernatural reality matters much, much more than liberal conservatives might actually say. There's a middle ground. They're both important. There is a responsibility that we have that is much greater than what classic conservatives, Christianity would suggest, that the material world needs to be renewed. It also means that there is a hope. There will be life where there was death. And the first installment, or that first down payment, is here. It's why we celebrate the Easter resurrection. What we heard in Kathy's testimony today is that there can be supernatural life that comes out of death. Broken people, physically, relationally, emotionally, can now be made whole, which is why when we hear of someone's conversion or that come to Jesus moment, as I mentioned, we celebrate, right? We celebrate. Why? Because they're resurrected. They're resurrected. And this is also why when we take a collection, you know, the basket gets passed on Sunday, and a portion of it goes to the local and international missions, you know, like giving to the poor, et cetera, because we believe that there can be a supernatural life that comes out of death. Poverty, injustice, exploitation, all of these things can be overcome by sacrifice. Life that comes out of death. In fact, if you want to have an irrefutable testimony, true eyewitness accounts of the resurrection, all you need to do is talk to someone who has come to the saving knowledge of Christ as Savior. Like Kathy's testimony. Kathy, I'm sure, will tell you there is such a thing as a resurrection. And I'm sure there are many of you here. If I had asked you to come up, you would be able to tell about your resurrection moment. Can you see how this changes the way in which we should engage the world and the way we relate to everything? The resurrection turns the whole worldview on its head. The fact that the material world makes us incredibly responsible. We are to be passionate about compassion. We are to be agents of change, working and praying against poverty and racism and exploitation and injustice. But the fact that there can be a supernatural transformation makes us incredibly bold, or it should. It should make us incredibly hopeful, and it should make us incredibly courageous. The world can change. Our efforts aren't in vain. There is no situation beyond hope. There's no situation where there can be no resurrection. One day, there will be no racism. There will be no poverty. There will be no injustice. There will be no exploitation, no brokenness, because what you see in the resurrection of Jesus Christ is a world where there is no more death. This is a world where every sad thing will become untrue. Won't that be great? I'm going to wrap this up here with an illustration. It's one of the best illustrations that I can think of to pull this all together, and it comes from a children's book titled The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Familiar? Anyone? Written by C.S. Lewis. And in the story, there is a lion named Aslan, who is the king of Narnia. And what has happened is that Aslan is interceded to save the life of a child who had been taken captive to the White Witch. And he does it at the cost of his own life. Aslan is killed. And what happens is that because of an ancient law that went way back before the dawn of time, that when an innocent victim is killed in a traitor's stead, Aslan says, this is what he says, the table would crack and death itself would start working backwards. It's because of this deep magic that after dying this treacherous death, Aslan comes back to life. He's resurrected. And after he comes back to life, he goes to the courtyard of the witch. And in the courtyard of the witch, there are statues of mythical creatures, animals and people who were captured by the White Witch's spell. They were once alive, but now they're imprisoned in a tomb of stone. And when Aslan, he comes into the courtyard, he begins to breathe on each one of the statues, and something miraculous happens. Death itself starts working backwards. And this is what C.S. Lewis writes. He says, "Of course the children's eyes turned to follow the lion, but the sight they saw was so wonderful that they soon forgot about him. Everywhere the statues were coming to life. The courtyard no longer looked like a museum, but more like a zoo. Creatures were running after Aslan and dancing around him until he was almost hidden within the crowd. And instead of all that deadly white, the courtyard was now in a blaze of color. Glossy chestnut-sized set for centaurs, indigo horns for unicorn, dazzling plumage of birds, ready these brown dogs and satyrs, yellow stockings and crimson hoods, dwarfs and the birch girls in silver and the beach girls in transparent green, and the large girls in a green that was so bright that it was almost yellow. And instead of the deadly silence, the whole place rang with the sound of happy roarings and ringings and yelpings and barking and singing and cooings and neighing and stamping and shouts and hurrahs and songs and laughter." Do you see heaven like that? If you believe in the resurrection, if you believe that there was an empty tomb, then you'll see that this material world matters and that there is hope outside the walls of this world for this world. A world where death works itself backwards because Jesus has risen. So lastly, how do we get there? Well, it begins in the same way it began for Kathy, for all of us, for many of us. If we look at verse 7, where the man specifically mentions Peter, right? He says, "Go tell his disciples and Peter." So why do you think Peter is singled out? Anybody? He denied him, right? Why is he the guy who's getting mentioned specifically? It's precisely what you just said, because Peter is the one who fell the most. He's the one who fell the hardest. He was the insider who promised, right? He remained faithful, but he failed 3 times. Can you see how precise and surgical this actually is? This isn't just, this diffused message of restoration. This is not just a message for faceless people or nameless people. In a world of people who happen to hear, this is a message directed to Peter, directed to Mary Magdalene, directed to Mary, the mother of James and Salome, and you. Whether you're an insider who has fallen like Peter, or an outsider under any other circumstance who would not have been included, like Mary Magdalene, or Salome, whether you're a disappointment or whether you never got the chance or even took the chance, this is a text of grace. This is new life. This resurrection comes not on the basis of anything that you or I have done. This is for failed insiders and total outsiders. It is based solely on Jesus Christ, his death, and his new life for you. Do you believe it? Do you believe that you will see him just as he told you? In closing, I'll wrap up verses 9 to 20. So you learned this past week that the earliest and best manuscripts of Mark's gospel end at verse 8. However, the majority of the manuscripts include verses 9 to 20. And additionally, A number of manuscripts include a shorter ending in between verses 8 and 9. On the basis of both external evidence, Pastor Glenn brought this up, what do the earlier manuscripts say, and on the internal evidence, which asks, how does the language style of Mark compare with the rest of Mark's gospel? Scholars are virtually unanimous in agreeing that Mark did not write these final verses, nor the so-called shorter ending. At the same time, these final verses clearly draw on the apostolic tradition, though. We can only speculate, really, as to why our earliest and best copies of Mark's gospel end at verse 8. Some believe this sudden, like, cryptic ending was intentional. You know, perhaps Mark's way of leaving his Roman readers trembling or stunned or mute and fearful before this awesome God. And others might surmise that the final page of Mark's writing got lost in transition. So biblical translators of the second or fourth centuries tried to complete the Gospel of Mark with two different endings. Neither the long or the short adequately fits the spirit of Mark's style of writing. And one commentator writes, if a choice has to be made, let Mark be known as the unfinished gospel, with verse 8 as the last, but not final word. So our takeaway for these final verses is to go. To go. Tell others about your resurrected life. Do you believe it? Do you believe that you will see him just as he told you? If you do, you will go and you will tell. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this morning. Thank you for your word. Thank you for your son. Oh, I just love that. I love that the tomb was empty, Lord. All for us. So, Lord, as they split off into their groups, Lord, may your spirit go with each person here. May your spirit continue to move in their hearts and in their minds, and may they have great conversation that is pleasing to you. Jesus, protect us as we leave here today with the rain, the crazy weather. And Lord, again, we just thank you for this place. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you, ladies.